which bit are you
going to
then?
I'm going to let you read that, right. That part.
Good morning, everybody. The International Aid Society and its partners are proud to sponsor a number of prestigious scientific prizes and awards at AIDS 2010. The prizes and awards are aimed at rewarding promising researchers doing outstanding research on HIV and AIDS. The ISCCABA Prize for Excellence in Research Related to the Needs of Children Affected for AIDS is being awarded today. This prestigious $2,000 prize is jointly offered by the IAS and the Coalition on Children Affected by AIDS. One prize is awarded to an investigator whose abstract demonstrates excellence in research that is likely to lead to improved services for children affected by HIV and AIDS. Introduce yourself
first. Good morning. My name is Lorraine Scher, and I'm part of the steering group for the Coalition CICABA, and it's an absolute privilege for me, amongst a team of industrious people who work for children, to award this prize, the 2010 Prize for Excellence in Research related to the needs of children affected by AIDS, is awarded to Priscilla Akwara from UNICEF. Priscilla comes from Kenya. She submitted and presented yesterday an absolutely excellent abstract, Who is the Vulnerable Child? Using survey data to identify children at risk in the era of HIV and AIDS, which is a quality abstract that allows us to have solid evidence base for decision making, and we're thrilled. We're also going to give her a wonderful certificate from the IAS today. But in addition to that, we've got some drawings because we felt as children we should have something from the people for whom Priscilla serves. Her real population. And these are two children affected by HIV and AIDS from South Africa. Priscilla.
Without further ado, it gives me a great pleasure to introduce the plenary session of this morning. And I would like to introduce for you the co-chairs of the session who will be in charge of introducing the speakers. Ashkor Alexander is director of Abahan, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation Global Health Program HIV Prevention Initiative in India. He leads strategy development for the initiative, identifies effective programs and oversees grant-making. Alexander works closely with India's central and state governments, non-governmental NGOs, and corporate partners in this very, very extremely successful initiative that the Gates Foundation has run in India. Next, I'd like to introduce to you, with great pleasure, and in fact it is my honor, to introduce the First Lady of Georgia, Mrs. Sandra Elizabeth Rudolph, who is an advocate for the United Nations Millennium Development Goals, with a special focus on the reduction of maternal and child mortality, extreme poverty, and infectious diseases. She truly knows that universal access is the way to the Millennium Development Goals. She currently works as a nurse in Tbilisi. We're honored to have her with us here today. And finally, I'd like to introduce to you Jeffrey Sturcio, who is the President and CEO of the Global Health Council. He was a long-time leader at Merck Company, a long-term partner in the fight against HIV and AIDS, whose quiet diplomacy led to programs treating more than 100,000 AIDS patients in Botswana, as well as protecting millions of Africans from river blindness. Sturcio worked for nearly two decades at Merck, starting as the company's first corporate activist, and ending as Vice President Corporate Responsibility, as well as President of the Merck Company Foundation. Let us welcome these three grand heroes of the global fight against HIV and AIDS today.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Ashok Alexander, and it's my great pleasure to introduce the first plenary speaker, Professor Carlos Caceres. Carlos F. Caceres is Professor of Public Health at Cayetano Heredia University and Director of the Institute of Studies in Health, Sexuality, and Human Development in Lima. He obtained his medical degree from Cayetano Heredia University in 1988, and his master's and doctoral degrees in public health epidemiology from the University of California, Berkeley, in 1991 and 1996. At present, he is co-editor of Sexuality, Health and Society and a member of the UNAIDS Prevention Reference Group. Professor Caceres is also a member of the IAS Governing Council.
Thank you very much for the honor of this invitation. As you see, we have changed the title of our talk to reflect how we feel about the role that this approach, combination prevention, could play in the longer-term response to HIV if well understood and applied. The topic of combination prevention was highlighted in discussions in the last conference, and it's increasingly taken into account and as a sensible way to go in policy debates. For example, the UNAIDS outcome framework identifies 10 priority areas for focused support by the UN system at country level, including reducing sexual transmission, preventing people who use drugs from getting HIV infection, removing punitive laws, policies, and HIV-related stigma and discrimination, stopping violence against women and girls, and strengthening social protection systems, all these linked in a combination prevention framework. However, combination prevention has not yet become a guiding principle of HIV programming. In part, such limitations in reach result from doubts among certain actors about the novelty, feasibility, efficiency, and even need of combination prevention. A lot of that, we feel, is a result of confused views of this concept. So our goal today will be to clarify concepts about combination prevention, argue that structural interventions, including human rights strategies, are central in HIV prevention, and discuss how and why it can provide a standard for a next phase of the global HIV response. Part of the general conviction around combination prevention stems from agreement that there are serious problems with the way HIV prevention programs are planned and delivered, and concerns that too much debate went on pitting one intervention or approach against others, when it's clear that reducing HIV incidence at the national level requires multiple strategies when they are coordinated and mutually supporting. While conceptually over the past 30 years we have moved from understanding risk groups to risk practices to cultural context and social vulnerability, most of our prevention work has remained focused on changing individual behaviors and lately susceptibility to infection and infectiousness. Moreover, our programs are not only dispersed, but the few good standards are applied only to a limited extent, in part due to insufficient dissemination. Moreover, there are still controversies as to what the right way to approach prevention should be, even among scientists. Also, as Bertozzi and colleagues pointed out, our programs are fragmented and scattered. Perhaps the most critical problem is that we focus on short-term change. This largely derives from limitations in our causal models, but also from the emergency response model prevailing in HIV, and from the need to demonstrate the impact of investments during the life of projects or studies. Finally, most of prevention work in the world is never evaluated, so technically we learn very little about its impact, in part due to limited investment in prevention evaluation research. Still, over 54% of global prevention expenses are focusing on the general population, broadly defined. Classifying countries' epidemics by epidemic level, this graph shows that prevention expenses on most at-risk populations in low-level and concentrated epidemics are still below 7% of total prevention spending, with men who have sex with men as the least attended group, with less than 1% in both cases. In generalized epidemics, the situation is even worse, with less than 1% of prevention spending focused on groups most at risk in general. While our understanding of HIV epidemiology has been guided by the Anderson and May equation, focusing on factors affecting the reproductive number, and much HIV programming has used a proximal determinants model, basic public health recognizes that health outcomes are also a function of their environment. Individual aspirations and conduct are shaped by interacting individual characteristics with their socially and culturally defined meanings, by relationships, by the services and conditions in their communities and organizations, by broader social, cultural, legal, political, and economic, and even physical and environmental factors at societal or national level and beyond. We all know that combination prevention emerged as a term only a few years ago as analogous to combination treatment, one of the most important achievements in the HIV response. This graph, cited by Coates and colleagues in the Lancet series, brought the analogy even further by using the expression highly active HIV prevention to call the combination of behavioral and biomedical strategies, ARV treatment, social justice and human rights, in a context of leadership and community involvement. It's true that the concept of combination prevention is used in more than one single form. However, we will briefly describe three types. Type one is the tactic of combining two or more intervention strategies. For example, needle and syringe programs plus opiate substitution programs. In 2009, NIH issued a call for applications for pilot studies to identify and test the feasibility of combined strategies for prevention. However, the call was restricted to biomedical and behavioral prevention and excluded structural interventions. Type 2 is about combining diverse strategies to fit the needs of diverse subgroups in the population. For example, to jointly launch information and services tailored for several subpopulations found to be at risk. Finally, type 3 would be the strategic combinations of biomedical, behavioral, and structural approaches to address key causes of HIV risk and vulnerability for a particular population. For example, joint strategies to empower women or to involve men in contexts with high incidence related to concurrent partnerships, or working with MSM and trans people with behavioral change promotion, STI treatment and antiretrovirals, decriminalization of homosexuality and community mobilization, or likewise with injection drug users in needle and syringe programs, opioid substitution, decriminalization of drug use and mobilization. The type 3 combination prevention is, in essence, the definition agreed upon by the UNAIDS Prevention Reference Group, which emphasizes the use of biomedical, behavioral, and social structural strategies operating at multiple levels to efficiently respond to needs based on prioritization, partnership, and community engagement. So, more appropriately, we are talking about evidence-informed, comprehensive, strategic, human rights-based programming. In essence, this is not a new concept, but a synthesis of the most important lessons learned in HIV prevention over three decades already. When saying evidence-informed, we refer to three kinds of evidence. First, epidemiological patterns and trends. For example, data on where the new cases will come from. Second, main drivers of those epidemiological trends. for example, proximal and distal, social and biological drivers. And finally, knowledge of available interventions for those epidemiological patterns and their drivers, designed within a human rights framework, as pointed out by Yves Souterrain last Sunday. This graph by Case and colleagues presented at this conference illustrates the potential of combination prevention in the future. For 22 of the hardest hit countries in the world, together accounting for 75% of the global burden of HIV, the AIDS 2031 modeling work group made more projections for the possible course of the epidemic. In the status quo scenario, with coverage of interventions remaining at today's level, there will be 45 million new cases between now and 2031. In an alternative scenario called scaled intervention, where many of today's interventions were combined and scaled up, including circumcision, counseling and testing, treatment and community mobilization in generalized epidemics, as well as condom use and harm reduction among those at greatest risk in concentrated epidemics, by 2031 there will be 29 million cases overall. This means that over the next couple of decades, of 45 million infections expected in status quo conditions, 25 million, or 57%, are avertible. One simple way to classify HIV prevention interventions considers three broad categories. First, behavior interventions, the most traditional prevention work focused on individual behavior change to reduce exposure of infectivity. For example, reducing number of partners, using condoms, using clean needles. Second, biomedical prevention, which encompasses approaches where the use of biomedical tools or procedures is key. For example, circumcision, several strategies using antiretrovirals, such as PMTCT or PEP, the inclusion of treatment as prevention, as has extensively been discussed during the conference, or the still experimental PrEP vaccines and microbicides, of which we heard exciting news this week. Of course, they are not purely behavioral or biomedical strategies, and there is some overlap in their components. Since 1995, several authors started to work on structural interventions, including Swed, Parker, Agleton, Somartojo, Blankenship, Pronick, and colleagues. And we also have the 2008 Lancet review by Gupta and colleagues, and papers emerged from the AIDS 2031 Social Drivers Working Group. Structural interventions are those focused on aspects of the social, political, economic, and even physical environment that determine people's vulnerability to HIV through restricting access to care and more general forms of social exclusion. For example, laws criminalizing HIV infection, sex work, drug use or homosexuality, state violations of rights, poverty leading to migration and transactional sex, cultural norms restricting people's sexual autonomy, or reproducing discrimination. Thinking concerning structural factors is supported by an extensive literature on social determinants of health, as synthesized not long ago by an ad hoc committee appointed by WHO. The main types of structural interventions involve changes in laws and regulations, as in the decriminalization transmission, drug use, sex work, or homosexuality, changes in culture and social norms, environmental enablers, as with increasing access to services, community mobilization and empowerment, and policy dialogue among stakeholders, for example, to foster social inclusion. This could be a snapshot of how behavioral and biomedical factors are influenced by various kinds of structural factors. I won't get into the details shown in this graph with behavioral, biomedical, and structural interventions, but we'll mention that structural interventions will include those in the social and cultural domain, for example, stigma reduction, those in the political and economic domain, for example, human rights, programming, or microfinance, and those addressing the physical environment, for example, infrastructure and transportation development. Now let's turn to the point about the role of human rights in this formulation and how it is more than just rhetoric. The protection of human rights is not only an ethical principle. It is central to effective prevention. Discrimination on the basis of HIV status, gender, sexual orientation, drug use or sexual practices deters people from accessing prevention services and makes them more vulnerable to infection. This is exacerbated where discrimination is institutionalized through law and policy. Good prevention planning starts with human rights analysis to understand people's needs and constraints in program design. It's not sufficient to just plan to protect human rights at the implementation. Moreover, environments protective of human rights unleash community and individual motivation to avoid HIV. For example, as already shown by Eve as well, Stratley and colleagues worked on the potential of combination prevention in IDU-driven epidemics. They modeled the potential impact of a human rights intervention in Ukraine. They highlight that policy practices could directly influence the risk of HIV acquisition by affecting where, when, with whom, and the context within which drugs are injected. For example, rushing injections, injecting in shooting galleries to avoid arrest. Those having experienced police beatings are more likely to report multi-person syringe use or use preloaded syringes. Effects are highest in Odessa, where 24% of IDUs report ever having been beaten by police. If assuming that without police beating, those individuals who have been beaten might behave more like those who have never been beaten, this model would predict a 4 to 19% reduction of new infections in Odessa between 2010 and 2015. Clearly a very meaningful reduction. Another study also modeled the impact of stigma on PMTCT interventions. In essence, they predicted that stigma and discrimination reduced the impact of PMTCT programs. In high-capacity settings, such reduction in impact could lead to 55% additional perinatal infections. Stigma could reduce the effectiveness of MTCT by reducing the proportion of women getting HIV tested, mothers taking nevirapine, the proportion of children getting prophylaxis, and adherence to feeding guidelines. Critics of combination prevention tend to misinterpret the concept as doing everything for everyone, including the kitchen sink, which is quite different from what this approach calls for. It's also said to be unfeasible. Well, data on effectiveness of combination already exists. Studies like Sonagachi, Image, Stepping Stones, or Avahan have allowed many lessons to be learned. For example, the Image trial showed a 55% reduction of intimate partner violence, a key factor of HIV transmission among women in South Africa who received a combination intervention of microfinance and gender and HIV education. Political courage to focus where needs are and capacity to deliver are also crucial. The Avahan project in India was also one impressive example of a combination prevention initiative, which began with a standardized package of biomedical and behavioral services adapted to local settings through microplanning and delivered to scale, including peer-led outreach, STI services, and condom distribution, and then added structural interventions like support for community mobilization and advocacy to promote human rights and reduce harassment. The impact of the Avahan intervention on HIV incidence may be inferred through modeling the observed changes in HIV prevalence and reported behaviors. This interim analysis by Pickles and colleagues compares a model based on observed data with another model based on no projection for what might have happened with no intervention. Although still in progress, this analysis suggests a moderate decline in incidence, which will be reflected in lower HIV prevalence in the coming years. On modeling the potential effects of combination prevention, let's see an example from my own country, Peru, where HIV is heavily concentrated on MSM and transgender populations. This model by Bayer and colleagues shows the role of a combination prevention package for MSM, including condom and lubricant promotion and distribution, community-level behavior interventions, and antiretrovirals on the total number of HIV infections per year, not just MSM. The green line about current levels of prevention and care among MSM shows new infections per year that continue to increase. The blue line with 100% coverage of MSM prevention and ARVs, the number of new infections clearly starts to decline. So high coverage of interventions for the most affected group, MSM and trans, is necessary to reverse the trajectory of the epidemic in Peru. With more myths about the combination prevention, it's also said that it cannot be evaluated. While it's difficult to map and prove the causal chain, some examples mentioned have been evaluated. It's easier, however, to assess combinations of interventions at similar levels of proximity. We also need something like combination evaluation. Finally, right now, we cannot quickly tell if any prevention program has had any effect on new HIV infections or not. And this lack of information weakens the case for further investment in prevention. We still need impact measures, particularly if we're moving from an emergency approach to a long-term response. We really need an incidence test to rapidly measure changes in incidence following interventions. Nevertheless, prevalence trends and modeling are good at telling us what happened retrospectively after many years. Now, for example, this graph from Hallett and colleagues shows the utility of modeling to retrospectively assess changes in the epidemic over time, mainly when looking at national responses, and hence assessing the potential role of interventions rolled out prior to those changes. In Zimbabwe, around 1990, there was a natural decline in new infections because the epidemic had spread amongst those at highest risk of infection and was moving into lower risk groups. But then, 10 years later, in approximately the year 2000, there seems to have been another decline in incidence, a larger one, that was more likely driven by individuals changing their own behavior. It's more likely that the second change was associated with individual behavior change because it was too large to be explained by anything else. Is it too expensive? The cost balance is the focus of ongoing discussion. For example, to what should combination prevention be compared? Likewise, benefits to be counted should include synergy, comprehensiveness of the response, the human rights added value, and sustainability, among others. We just must remember that those effects are often not immediate. Fortunately, costs are not the same across interventions, and for structural interventions, legal and policy changes may bear much lower or one-time costs. Economic and cultural changes, such as the promotion of gender equity and economic opportunities, should be seen as broader development structural interventions with a key added value in HIV prevention. As such, should help in the integration of HIV programming within the bigger picture of development. Importantly, WHO, ARASA, and others have engaged in initial efforts to coast a range of human rights interventions that are essential for expanded ART programs. Based on data from Southern Africa, public sector interventions, including human rights training or service providers, Know Your Rights campaigns, monitoring of human rights abuses, and access to justice initiatives were costed. And as it is evident from this graph, costs of human rights interventions constitute only 1.4% of total expanded ART program costs. Stigma has effects on a number of interventions, not only in prevention, but also in treatment, care, and support. If we effectively reduce stigma, we are not only likely to increase coverage and effects of our programs, but such improved effects on incidence and morbidity may in fact help reduce stigma further. We have, however, to continue studying how stigma can effectively be reduced. We know it's not only a matter of information and training, but of dealing with people's deep fears and concerns beyond rational arguments. Some studies are being conducted, but we need more research in this area. For example, this is a collage of pictures from Bochinche, or Festive Uproar, a combination of structural actions to reduce stigma around sex work of women and transgender people in Peru. Funds were only available to conduct a qualitative evaluation, although the intervention led to a meeting in Congress and to a proposal for law reform. It included a series of demonstrations as well as a virtual component with a video seen over 60,000 times in YouTube. You can see a display of this at the art gallery in the Global Village in Vienna, here in Vienna. Again, since many good programs never get evaluated, perhaps we have to find ways to better produce post hoc assessments of such experiences and to agree on how such evidence can be considered for planning. This is again to show that the more distal structural interventions with regard to HIV tend to have broader development effects concerning gender equity or poverty reduction or inclusion of sexual minorities and social justice. So this is a very important graph. We need to begin understanding our actions as not necessarily having all effects in 1 or 2 years, as in traditional HIV education, but also having effects in 3 to 5 years, as in community empowerment, or even in more than 5, as with the promotion of gender equity, and to think of them in combination and to take advantage of their synergy. This quotation from Kevin Moody from the Global Network of People Living with HIV showing positive health, dignity and prevention as a combination approach also highlights the centrality of the person, the crucial links between prevention and treatment, and the importance of community leadership. To finish, some key challenges for combination prevention include the need for better tools to know our epidemics, particularly to ascertain model incidence and to better estimate the size of populations, and the need to close the evidence gap, including gathering better impact effectiveness data, resolve contradictions in our models and amongst ourselves, and even improve our conceptualization of combination prevention. So here are a few take-home messages. At this point, it's clear that the focus on individuals is not sufficient. Combination prevention is not about implementing a rigid panel of redundant interventions. Rather, it's the strategic, evidence-informed combination of biomedical, structural, and behavioral strategies in a human rights framework. Investing in structural interventions is not only an ethical obligation, it's worth the cost. And it's particularly critical at the point when we are switching our thinking to ensuring a sustained long-term response to HIV. In that way, it may be called to become a standard in the long-term response to HIV. Perhaps this view of combination prevention could become the flagship of a recent call for a prevention revolution that Dr. Sidibe has emphasized at this conference, where a new diplomacy for prevention should seek to change mindsets in the context of the need to strategically and long-term conduct our work if we're really to tackle the epidemic in the next decade or two. Let me end with a brilliant quote from the Commission on AIDS in Asia. The successful implementation of HIV interventions therefore demands, first of all, that local barriers be addressed and that an enabling environment is created. This is not difficult to achieve. Often, what appears to be intractable resistance to respecting the basic rights of most at-risk groups yields to thoughtful advocacy and bridge-building with local authorities and power breakers. I am greatly indebted to my co-authors, Bracy de Salduondo, Tim Hallett, Carlos Avila, and Michaela Clayton, to the AIDS 2010 focal points, Kieran Daly and Kate Thompson, to many authors who shared their data generously, and to numerous colleagues whose support was extremely important. Thank you very much.
Hello to all of you, and we are very much looking forward to the presentation of Elaine Abrams. Elaine, Professor Abrams, is coming to us from New York, where she started out as a biochemist and became a medical doctor, specializing in pediatrics and family care, and focusing on mother-to-child transmission. She not only works on prevention and care, but also on research, clinical trials, and policy making through preparing guidelines for MCT. She is a real asset to our MTCT agenda. So I'm happy to ask Professor Abrams to come forward. She is also a WHO advisor and also for the U.S. Public Health Service and a professor at the Milman School of Public Health and Columbia University. Professor Abrams. Thank you.
Good morning, and thank you to the organizers for inviting me to be part of this extremely important meeting and to be part of this very distinguished panel of speakers. I'm quite honored to be able to bring the issues of women and children to the audience this morning. I'll be speaking with you about eliminating vertical transmission, otherwise known as mother-to-child transmission. I'll talk some about the background and how to do it and what we face moving forward. So in 2008, there were 430,000 new pediatric infections, reaching over 2 million infections in children globally. There were 390,000 deaths attributed to pediatric HIV alone in 2008. Of the 1,200 new infections occurring daily, more than 90% are estimated to be attributed to vertical transmission. During the opening plenary, Julio Montaña noted, put forward the agenda for treatment for prevention, and noted that this has been a well-established methodology in the area of vertical transmission, that antiretroviral treatment can prevent transmission of infections to babies. This is indeed true, and in settings like where I come from in the U.S., where we've had widespread access to antiretroviral therapy, we've seen remarkable successes in the area of vertical transmission, with transmission rates less than 1 to 2%. In New York State, where I work, we had 6 new infections in 2008. This compares fairly dramatically with efforts in high prevalence, high burden settings, where in 2008, it's estimated that only 70,000 pediatric infections were averted, and 200,000 averted infections since we first started prevention programs more than a decade ago. So let's step back and just take a moment to review some of the basic concepts around vertical transmission of HIV. As depicted on this timeline, transmission can occur during pregnancy, labor, and delivery, and postpartum during breastfeeding. Not all infants born to women living with HIV will acquire infection. It's estimated that 25 to 45% will acquire HIV without any intervention. And the proportion of children who acquire infection varies by the timing of exposure. As you can see, a greater percentage of infections occur during labor and delivery compared with pregnancy. And infection during breastfeeding depends on whether the baby breastfeeds exclusively or mixed and duration of feeding. Over the last decade, we've identified multiple factors that relate to or are associated with the risk of transmission: maternal, infant, host, viral, and obstetric factors. But two factors really trump the rest. Women with advanced HIV disease are at highest risk for transmission and also at the highest risk for their own disease progression and death. And antiretroviral medications given at any point along that timeline, during pregnancy, labor and delivery, or during breastfeeding, can significantly decrease the risk of vertical transmission. And if given to mothers for their own health, can also result in the expected gains in maternal morbidity and mortality. So in 1999, Garcia and colleagues elegantly identified the relationship between maternal health status or viral load and the risk of transmission. As you can see in this slide, women who had high viral loads greater than 100,000 at delivery had very high risk of transmission, with 40% of those non-breastfeeding babies acquiring HIV. This compares dramatically with no transmissions occurring among the 57 women who had viral loads at delivery less than 1,000. More recently, Kuhn and colleagues looked at women enrolled in the Zambia Exclusive Breastfeeding Study. This was a study of breastfeeding and weaning practices in Zambia prior to the widespread availability of ART. Women were staged during pregnancy and received a CD4 count. Kuhn and colleagues applied the new WHO guidelines for ART eligibility to these women and found that 54% had a CD4 count less than 350, and overall 68% of the 1,000 women they studied were eligible for ART. When they looked at transmission amongst the babies in this cohort, they found that 88% of the babies who acquired HIV during pregnancy and delivery were born to women who were eligible for ART, and 88% of the postnatal transmissions occurred within the same group. Furthermore, looking at maternal deaths, there were 75 maternal deaths within 24 months of delivery. Almost all of those deaths occurred, as one might expect, among the women who were eligible for treatment. Maternal health influences child health outcomes in a number of other ways. Children born to women with advanced HIV disease are also at higher risk of developing AIDS or dying if they indeed become HIV infected. And also at higher risk of death in unexposed babies born to women with advanced HIV disease. In some very eloquent work in Uganda, Merman and colleagues identified the use of ART and cotrimoxazole in adults requiring treatment in the household. When they treated these adults, they found a reduction in death among children within the household, as well as a startling reduction in orphanhood. So let's now turn to the traditional four pillars of prevention of vertical transmission of HIV, on which the global response is based. We'll first start by looking at prevention of HIV infection in women, a topic that's been covered widely in this conference. In sub-Saharan Africa, 60% of adults and 75% of youth living with HIV are women, and female youth are at disproportionately high risk of acquiring HIV. Recent studies suggest that pregnant and postpartum women may be at even higher risk for new HIV infections during this vulnerable period. For women living in countries in generalized epidemics, it's now been well demonstrated that the greatest risk of acquiring HIV infection is through marriage or cohabitation, the very time when one thinks about starting a family. And gender and power inequity put women at increased risk for HIV acquisition. And this is particularly poignant in marginalized populations like sex workers and IDUs. To date, few prevention methods have been made available to women, and they rely primarily on male and female condoms. But I'm sure there isn't a single person in this room today who isn't excited about the promising news from Caprisa 004 about the tenofovir microbicide gel. Also, there's recent evidence of other progress in the area of prevention. A new UNAIDS report cites declines in HIV prevalence among youth in 15 countries and shows evidence of positive changes in behavior that are associated with this decline in prevalence. And I'd like to point out in particular a new study in Malawi where girls and their families were randomized to cash incentives as a way to keep them in school and lower HIV prevalence. And they found in this randomized study that these cash incentives actually were associated with improved school attendance and lower HIV prevalence. If we move on to prong two, prevention of unwanted pregnancies, given an estimated 80 million unintended pregnancies annually among women, it's not surprising that there's a high unmet need for family planning among women living with HIV, with high rates of unintended pregnancy being reported at 50 to 90%. Increasing family planning and contraceptive use can be an effective strategy to prevent new pediatric infections. Unfortunately, policy and funding restrictions over the last decade have led to somewhat strained relationships between HIV and reproductive health programs, but relaxation of those policies and new funding for family planning will allow us to move forward in the field, providing family planning to women who want to prevent or delay pregnancy. Yesterday, I was stopped by an esteemed colleague, Dr. Ruth Ndwati, who suggested that we just change the name of this prong to ensuring safe motherhood. Many adults with HIV, particularly in the context of increased ART availability, are expressing a high desire for wanting children. Women on ART in Nairobi slum describe motherhood as proof of recovery and a way to regain self-status. And in many ART programs are now reporting women starting treatment and becoming pregnant shortly thereafter. I don't have the expertise or the time today to go through the multiple factors that influence reproductive decision-making in adults living with HIV, but this table is meant to display the complexity of this kind of decisions and the appropriate interventions. I do want to point out in particular two areas that have been very vulnerable to human rights, the attitudes of health providers, and policies and guidelines and legal considerations. So if I move on now to Pillar 3, prevention of transmission of HIV from an infected woman to her infant. In 1999, Laura Gay and Philippa Musoka reported the results of HIVnet-012, which demonstrated that a single dose of nevirapine to the mother and a single dose of the nevirapine to the baby, to the newborn, to the mother in labor, could result in a 40% reduction in vertical transmission of HIV. And this was really transformational and led to the first vertical transmission programs in high-prevalence, resource-constrained settings. Coupled with rapid tests, women attending antenatal clinics could be counseled, tested, and given a pill that could save the life of their child. An open access program by Boehringer Ingelheim Pharmaceutical and the heroic and relentless efforts of the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric Foundation and their local partners facilitated the rapid expansion of PMTCT programs using single-dose nevirapine throughout Africa and many other parts of the world. But progress has been stalled, and despite a dramatic change in the landscape of HIV treatment, women and children appear to be falling behind. In 2008, only 21% of women worldwide received an HIV test, pregnant women. 45% of women estimated to be living with HIV received prophylaxis, and only 32% of the newborns received any ARV prophylaxis. If we look more specifically at sub-Saharan Africa, we see some better results, with 58% of pregnant women having received any form of ARV prophylaxis. And if we look at this more complex figure of the 20 high-burden countries in sub-Saharan Africa, accounting for 80 to 85% of new pediatric infections. We see in purple the total number of HIV-positive women, pregnant women, and in orange, HIV-positive pregnant women who receive prophylaxis. There are a number of countries that have done very well, Botswana with 95% coverage and South Africa with 73%, but Nigeria in particular and several others are way behind. Nigeria's 210,000 positive pregnant women, of which an estimated 10% received any prophylaxis. So we have to remember that most prevention programs have been layered onto the maternal child health setting. That gives us an opportunity to look at key determinants that are influencing uptake and success. Three major determinants are utilization of mother-child health services, particularly ANC and maternity services. The level of national scale-up of transmission prevention programs, and particularly decentralization to the primary health level. And the depth of vertical transmission prevention services, particularly implementation of a more comprehensive package of programming. So let's look at two scenarios that lead to low uptake of prevention programs in Ethiopia. Low ANC utilization accounts for the poor overall uptake of ARV prophylaxis in positive women. In Nigeria, by comparison, limited ANC utilization and poor penetration of services account for this large unmet need. In 2006, WHO revised their guidelines to include short course AZT during pregnancy and short course to the baby, and emphasized the need to actually initiate treatment to HIV-positive pregnant women with CD4 counts less than 200. But there's been a limited depth of services for prevention of vertical transmission and a very slow transition from single-dose nevirapine to multi-drug regimens. Few women are having CD4 testing, there's been a low rate of ART utilization during pregnancy, and weak linkages for long-term follow-up. If we look at ARV use across low- and middle-income countries in 2007 and 2008, we see that only about 10% of women with known regimens are getting ART therapy. And in our programs at the International Center for AIDS Care and Treatment, programs where we support through PEPFAR, PMTCT in 11 countries in Africa, we've seen a change from single-dose nevirapine over the last 3 years to more multi-drug ARV regimens, but little increase in the use of therapeutic ART during pregnancy. And in Botswana, a program with a highly successful ART program, we see the complexities of trying to provide women who are eligible with ART. Among 668 women identified during pregnancy who are treatment naive, only 60% receive CD4 counts, and only 23 of 62 women who had CD4 counts less than 200 actually initiated ART. A stock out of CD4 reagent contributed to the CD4 issue. If we look at the other side of the equation, there's been limited depth of services for the HIV-exposed infants with low rates of prophylaxis and difficulty with the uptake of infant feeding guidelines for exclusive breastfeeding. And there have been very weak systems for infant follow-up, with only 8% of exposed babies receiving life-saving cotrimoxazole and 15% of children getting early infant diagnosis. Finally, I would be remiss if I didn't turn to the last prong and focus particularly on those children who acquire HIV infection. Children lag behind adults in the ART scale-up. There have been 275,000 children who have initiated ART worldwide, only 38% of the estimated need. WHO has recommended for almost 2 years that all infants start ART upon diagnosis, but relatively few have actually been initiated worldwide, primarily due to a high loss to follow-up at each step in the cascade from delivery through infant testing to engagement in HIV care. So let's turn back and think about this overall problem. The MCH is the home for women and children, their medical home, and they get a core set of services within the MCH. We've successfully integrated vertical transmission prevention services within the MCH and have moved forward with some prevention activities. Simultaneously, with the rapid scale-up and successful initiation of treatment for more than 5 million individuals, we've established a series of services or a core package that need to be provided in order to appropriately treat individuals for HIV. And these are noted here, often given in the ART clinic or HIV care and treatment program. I'd like to propose that until we successfully bring all of these services together, we are not going to be able to adequately eliminate vertical transmission. And this kind of integration or linkage is going to take huge effort and creativity, but without it and without addressing the health needs, particularly of the pregnant woman, we will not be able to go further. First and foremost, this will require unyielding pressure to have equal access and open access to ART for every individual in the world who requires treatment, particularly for pregnant women and children. We've already begun to see the impact of ART services on child health in the study by Ndirangu from the Africa Center that was published earlier in the year in AIDS that began to see a decline in early life mortality, first with the introduction of PMTCT services in 2001, and then later when they implemented ART programs in KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa, began to see even greater gains in under two mortality and postnatal mortality. And at this meeting, they presented further data showing a relationship between maternal ARV and under five mortality in the same area. There have also been some accomplishments in programs in vertical transmission that require mention. Despite the CD4 problems I noted, vertical transmission rates have been less than 5% in Botswana, with a widespread scale-up and equal access to ART, as well as vertical transmission programs. In a recent assessment of early transmission among children in immunization clinics in KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa, showed early transmission rates of 7%, which compared with a very similar study in 2004 to 2005, which had a 21% transmission rate, a really fabulous drop in the number of children acquiring HIV. And multiple country and program reports are now documenting lower transmission rates among women and infants receiving PMTCT interventions. So I'd say there's no better time than right here and right now to move this agenda forward. We have sound scientific evidence. We have new guidelines that are being distributed and announced at this meeting for the use of ART for treatment of pregnant women and prevention of vertical transmission, as well as new infant feeding guidelines. And these guidelines suggest that women start treatment with CD4s less than 350, like all adults, and emphasize the importance of CD4 testing. They also extend the duration of prophylaxis throughout pregnancy and for 1 year postpartum so women can safely breastfeed their babies. We have successful experience implementing complex ART programs that need to be applied to women and children, and we have highly visible interest and commitment from UN family, international agencies, and donors. With a new campaign for virtual elimination of mother-to-child transmission. So the time is right here and right now, and I urge everyone to join this movement. It is possible, it is feasible, and we can prevent babies from becoming infected, and we can keep women and families healthy. I'd like to end thanking you. And I'd like to, in particular, bring to note three people. Dr. Alan Rosenfield, the dean, was the dean of the School of Public Health, who is a lifelong advocate for the rights of women. Dr. Alan Berkman, who is instrumental in the Treatment Access Campaign and who made access and equity the hallmark of his career. And Dr. Wafa El-Sadr, a mentor and colleague who many of you must know but or are probably working with on projects today, whose inspiration, unending enthusiasm has been a dominant force in our response worldwide to this epidemic. And I thank all my colleagues who were very patient with help with this presentation, and to all of the scientists and implementers who are contributing to the good health of women, children, and families. Thank you.
Hello. It's an honor to introduce the Jonathan Mann Memorial Lecture this year. The lecture was inaugurated at the 13th International AIDS Conference in Durban, South Africa. I'm reminded, actually, from what Elaine said, that I first met Alan Rosenfield at the Durban Conference, and it just brings back a lot of memories for all of us. This lecture is sponsored and supported by the Global Health Council. The Council also sponsors the Jonathan Mann Award for Global Health and Human Rights, together with JSI and IAPAC. The Jonathan Mann Memorial Lecture honors the memory and legacy of one of the key figures of the 20th century in the fight against global poverty and illness. Tragically, Jonathan Mann and his wife, Mary Lou Clements Mann, herself a world-renowned immunologist, were killed in the deadly crash of Swissair Flight 111 in September 1998. Jonathan Mann is best remembered for his extraordinary contributions as the visionary physician and public health official who clearly articulated the connection between poverty and ill health. He was the founder and first head of the World Health Organization's Global Program Against AIDS, and he believed that improved health couldn't be achieved without attention to basic human rights. I think it's fair to say that he would have applauded and certainly welcomed the theme of this year's conference, Rights Here, Right Now. And on that theme, it's a privilege for me to introduce this year's Jonathan Mann Memorial Lecturer, Meena Saraswathi Seshu. Meena is the General Secretary of Sampada Gramin Mahila Sanstha, or SanGram. It's a little easier to say that, at least for me. It's an organization based in Sangli, India, which has worked for the empowerment of people in sex work. Ms. Seshu has worked with marginalized populations, particularly rural women, adolescents, and people in sex work, on HIV and AIDS, sexual and reproductive health, violence against women, and gender and sexual minority rights through grassroots rights-based organizations in Karnataka and Maharashtra. Her title is No Excuses, A Living Experience of the Struggle for Rights. So please join me in welcoming Meena Seshu.
Thank you. Namaste. Good morning. I'm here to tell you a story of struggle and success. We struggled and we fought. It wasn't always clear that we would succeed, and sometimes we did not. I was trained as a social worker. As professional social workers, we are trained to guide communities. But our struggles reveal to us that this approach was not only faulty in achieving results, it was not ethical. For instance, what did we, a band of middle-class women, know about the sex worker community, but we were all ready to guide them? The sex worker community resisted all our attempts and taught us that effective interventions are only possible if we respect their knowledge, experience, and participation. They brought home to us the simple truth that top-down programs that are not guided by community knowledge, community experience, and community participation do not work. As we struggled, we learned that pragmatically, only right-centered approaches actually worked. It was this approach that helped us reach 5,000 sex workers within 6 months. Our monthly requirement of condoms, hold your breath, reached 350,000 condoms a month within a year of starting the intervention. It was also this approach that showed us that when we decided to work with rural women, adolescents, young people, men who have sex with men, and trans people. I would like to begin by introducing you to my friend and colleague, Durga Pujari, who was one of our first outreach workers. Durga is now president of Veshya Anyay Mukti Parishad, VAMP, the collective of women in sex work who have struggled against injustice and triumphed. And I hope this works.
आणि मी एक धंदा करणार बाई आहे. आम्हाला कोण समाज माणसं म्हणून शेत जात नाही. ही धंदा करणार बाई आहे, ही वाईट बायका आहे, ही चांगलं बायका नाही. पोरांबद्दल ज्याला भेदभाव होत होतो, शाळामध्ये जात होतं, दहावीपर्यंत शिकवत होतं किंवा नववीपर्यंत शिकवत होतं, त्याच्या पुढं शिकू देतच नव्हतं. संस्था जी संग्राम संस्था रजिस्टर झालं, मग आम्ही बदली झालं की विश्वास पटला आम्हाला संस्थेमध्ये. बाबा निरोध एच आय व्ही एड्सबद्दल काम करायला लागलं. मग एच आय व्हीमध्ये काय मग माहीत नव्हतं, निरोध म्हणजे काय माहीत नव्हतं. मग निरोधबद्दल आम्ही ट्रेनिंग घ्यायला लागलं. मग आम्ही घेतल्यानंतर बायकांना ट्रेनिंग द्यायला लागलं मीटिंग दिवशी. आणि त्यामुळं डॉक्टरवर पण विश्वास पडला आमचं, काम करायला लागलं. त्यानंतर मग आमच्या जी कम्युनिटीमध्ये गटर असू दे किंवा काय पण कचरा काढायचा असू दे, नगरपालिकेला आम्ही जाऊन अर्ज द्यायला लागलं. मग तिने दिवशी सगळं गटर स्वच्छ करायला लागलं. मग डे टू डे पावडर टाकायला लागलं. वरच्यावर आमचं पण काळजी तिने घ्यायला लागला. पोलीस स्टेशनला वगैरे गेलं. मग गेलं काय भांडणं झालं, कुठं काय कम्युनिटी पोलिसांचं बरोबर. मग आमचं रिलेशन चांगलं बसलं. कंप्लेंट पण तिने घ्यायला लागलं आमचं. तसं टर्डरबरोबर काम करायला लागलं. मग टर्डरबरोबर काम करताना त्यांच्याबरोबर मैत्री करून घेतो. पहिल्यांदा एच आय व्ही एड्सबद्दल आम्ही माहिती सांगतो, त्यांना पुस्तक वगैरे देतो, निरोधबद्दल सांगतो, गुप्तरोगाबद्दल सांगतो आम्ही. बाबा त्यांना जर आमचं ऐकण्यात असलं, मैत्रीण खूप जोस्त झालं, तर सरकार दवाखान्यात नेऊन सेनी इथं इथं जावं म्हणून सांगतो त्यांना. पहिले साडी वगैरे घालत होतं, डोक्यावर पदर वगैरे घेत होतं. पण ते आता ड्रेस पण घालतो, गॉल पण घालतो, रोडवर वगैरे पण बसतो आम्ही, मेकअप वगैरे करतो. मग त्यामुळं की जसं दुसऱ्यांना अधिकार आहे तसं आम्ही पण बायका आहे, आम्हाला पण तसं समाजामध्ये अधिकार आहे.
थँक्यू दुर्गा. This community of sex workers taught us that they are the most effective educators of both their clients and other women in sex work. They helped us develop what we now call the Sangram Bill of Rights that comes from our experience in Sangli. I remember in 1993, the Information, Education and Communication Committee in charge of AIDS, Government of Maharashtra, this is the pre-National AIDS Control Organization days, one set out a long list of client negotiation strategies for sex workers. This included graphic photographs of STI symptoms, how to talk to men, convince them about condom use, etc. I was young, naive, and 29 years old. The HIV educator in me took the list, called a meeting, and sat down to discuss this new tool. Aparam Maushi, aunt, a brothel owner, listened to me patiently but couldn't stop laughing throughout the meeting. She made me understand how ridiculous I was being. She asked me directly if I had any knowledge or of dealings with men. the sex workers finally told me, "We know how to deal with clients. We know how to deal with men. You just get us good quality condoms and we'll do the rest." The first Sangram Bill of Rights was thus born. People have the right to be approached with humility and respect. Sex workers were not treated respectfully in the health services and thus avoided going to the civil hospital. The civil hospital approached us and told us that for the good of the sex worker community, Sangram should do a collaborative program with the civil hospital that would bring high quality medical services right to the doorstep of the community. So we called a meeting, told community leaders, and we set up a clinic just outside the brothels for treatment services. We spent a lot of money and set up a temporary structure just outside the brothel area, which had a medical unit, a counseling room, a mini lab. There were about 10 doctors. Imagine my horror when I went to the brothels the next day. The community was deserted, except for old women and very young children. They had actually run away from Sangli city and abandoned their houses to avoid getting treatment or being coerced into getting treatment. We were flabbergasted. We couldn't understand why they went flocking to these accessible services. The civil hospital doctors were furious. But we learned our lesson. You learn that you can't tell people they must get a test or they must be treated. You can explain and offer, but it must be in a way that allows them agency. It has to be a consultative process. Thus, the second bill. People have the right to say yes or no to things that concern them. In 1997, after the Collective of Women and Sex Work, WAMP, was registered, we felt we had done our duty and we wanted to close Sangram down. But the women of WAMP understood the epidemic better than most of us. Durga, who you just saw in the film, said that HIV was like a big river. And while working with sex workers, we had built only one dam. Building a dam at only one site will not stop a massive flood, she said. If we really want to stem the tide, we have to build dams at different bends of the river. She explained to us that men listened to sex workers about condoms, but they did not seem to even discuss sexual issues, forget condoms, with their wives. I remember she said maybe we needed to teach wives negotiation strategies. WAMP pushed Sangram to reach to married rural women and young people. The sex workers observed that young men were especially hard to convince about using condoms. They did not want to sacrifice sexual pleasure, and they did not want to hear the consequences of not using condoms. And thus, a rural non-sex worker program started. At that time, women living with HIV who were pregnant were told that they should have an abortion. There was no Nevirapine, no nothing. But even with the knowledge that many of these children will be born HIV negative, women were told to abort. The struggle was to create a safe space to discuss rights as well as legal and ethical issues affecting people living with HIV and AIDS. I would now like to introduce you to a member of Sangram Plus, the collective of women living with HIV AIDS from Sangli district.
टीबी झाली. टीबीचे औषध घेऊन देखील सतत सारखा आजार पडत असतो, म्हणून परत मी एच आय व्ही टेस्ट करून घेतलं. मला एच आय व्ही झालं. नंतर मी माझ्या बायकोचं देखील करून घेतलं. त्यावेळी माझं होतं सिडीपूर 39.
घरातल्यांना पण कळालं. मी त्या घरातल्यांना सांगितलं होतं डॉक्टरने अशा नसाय तुमच्या मुलगी तुम्ही पाठवून देऊ नका म्हणून. मग मी काय राहिले नाही. माझं माझ्या नवऱ्यावर प्रेम होतं. मग ते कानातलं विकलं मी. कानातलं विकून रिक्षा करून मी पळून आले त्यांच्या बरोबर. आणि ते पैसे थोडे होते ते त्यांचा दवाखाना पण मी केले.
डॉक्टरनी आम्हाला सल्ला दिला.
बाळाला कशाला जन्म देत आहे, बाळाला पण होईल.
पण डॉक्टरला माहित नव्हतं आम्हाला संग्राम संस्था
औषध पुरवठा झाला.
पुरवठा होऊन आमची मुलगी निगेटिव्ह.
आणि त्याने आम्हाला आधार देतात तुम्हाला तुमच्या बाळाला काय होत नाही, आम्ही तुम्हाला साथ देतो.
आमचा हक काय आम्हाला एक म्हणून तरी आम्हाला पाहिजेच होत.
आणि आता बाळ माझं चांगलं आहे. त तशीच परमेश्वरानं आमच्याकडे बघितलंय बघा. मी त्या मॅडमचं एक नाही पाया पडली की माझ्या मुलगीला काय झालेलं नाही, बरं आहे. भले आम्हाला दोघांना असू दे पण आमच्या मुलगीला नाही ना, त्याच्यात आम्हाला आनंद आहे. मी परमेश्वरालाही झाकली. मग तिथं मला अजूनपर्यंत हसते ते काय पुरगी आहे, लग्न होऊन नवऱ्यावर पळून गेल्या. मग लव मॅरेज म्हणत काय, लव मॅरेज झालं किंवा. मग आता आम्हाला असं वाटतंय की आम्ही जग जिंकलो.
Sangram Plus was born to help address the intersection of violence against women and HIV and AIDS. Women's rights are particularly difficult to talk about because they challenge traditional patriarchal structures. Sangram's solution to this is to create a collective consciousness in order to strengthen people's ability to assert their rights and negotiate safety. People have the right to reject harmful social norms. The challenges of reaching out to rural women and young girls were numerous and deep. Being accused of breaking up marriages, challenging sexual norms, helping young people get together to talk rationally about sex and HIV, reaching sheltered young girls, giving them the language of rights, and urging them to take control of their lives is not only a difficult task, it's near impossible in a conservative setup. Our interactive sexuality education classes are a riot. Our strong feminist perspective is difficult to digest for most young men. As is similar in most parts of the world, young men clamor for information on sexual pleasure, and the women, of course, are tailored to show more interest in reproductive health issues. We deal with controversial issues around sexual diversity in an open and honest manner. MSM, trans people, sex workers are part of the comprehensive sexuality education administered by the Sangram activists. Pleasure me safely is our slogan. People have the right to stand up and change the balance of power. Challenging social norms, challenging the most powerful in the district, police, village panchayat leaders, political leaders, upper caste leaders, developing a social discourse and eventually getting them, if not to be supporters, at least not obstacles, is the struggle. At the state and national level, some success has been achieved in the engagement with government and non-government actors, working with networks of sex workers, women's groups, HIV/AIDS activists, queer activists within the country and outside has resulted in concrete gains. Mobilizing the voices of sex workers as citizens and community leaders to influence Government of India to abandon its plan to amend the Immoral Traffic Prevention Act was without doubt one of our major successes. The amendment would have further stigmatized sex workers by criminalizing the purchase of sexual services. For women who did not think that they could go to the local police station, to help believe that they can talk to the group of ministers in Delhi is indeed an achievement. Armed with information from our international networks of sex workers, the Global Network of Sex Work Projects, NSWP, and the Asia-Pacific Network of Sex Workers, the National Network of Sex Workers India was able to argue that there is no evidence from any country that criminalizing demand is an effective strategy for preventing violence against sex workers, trafficking in persons into sex work, and certainly not HIV. In 2007, the National Network of Sex Workers India hosted the meeting of the Global Network of Sex Workers Projects to rewrite the UNAIDS guidance note on HIV and sex work, which was then presented to UNFPA and UNAIDS in Delhi by the Indian sex workers. But the most exciting journey has been the recent success in influencing the request for proposals to the Global Fund Round 10 from India. The National Network of Sex Workers set up a sex work-led consortium which was able to advocate for our inclusion as partners in the Ground 10 proposal from the Government of India. We are challenged by having to compete with large international NGOs for PR status. We are still calling for the sex worker-led consortium to be the primary recipient and are hoping that for the first time in the world, sex worker collectives will be given this right to choose their own homegrown representation to the Global Fund. We need the Global Fund to work for us. In our region, HIV became a problem at a time when the political power of religious fundamentalists was growing. It wasn't bad enough that sex workers were already harassed and abused by the police. Although it was clear that sex workers were a central part of the solution of HIV, to HIV, we have had to deal with centuries of entrenched stigma and social disdain. Religiously motivated vigilantes from India and eventually from conservative Christian groups in the United States who wanted to rescue sex workers from lives of immorality have targeted Sangram and VAMP for advocating for the rights of sex workers. The raids have been violent and conducted with missionary zeal and thug-like brutality. Raids only drive marginalized communities underground, and long-term community work gets disrupted. It was only the collective strength of VAMP that did not allow the HIV outreach program, condom distribution, and access to treatment services to be disrupted. The raids on VAMP established the Fifth Bill of Rights. People have the right not to be rescued. Repeat, not to be rescued by outsiders who neither understand nor respect them. In 2000, a small group of men from Sangli approached Sangram, asking for a program focused on men who have sex with men, Kotis and Jogappas. Koti is a self-identifying label for males who may feminize their behaviors. Jogappas are male Devadasis, a form of temple prostitution linked to the Hindu religion. I would like to tell you a story that has helped me understand the true meaning of rights. Pandu from Muskan, the collective of Kotis and Jogappas.
Pazana Pandu hai. Make sex work karu. Make sex work karsa mulga hai. Ani make devadasi hai. Maza shareer purusha sa asla tar maza man maza baiit sa hai. मी एक भुरगी दत्तक घेतलंय तिचं नाव सोनू आहे आणि ही एच आय व्ही पॉझिटिव्ह आहे आणि मी निगेटिव्ह आहे. मग माझ्या पुरगीला एक दिवस काहीतरी येईल विचार माझ्या पुरगी संघ तुमचा दादा साडी का नेसतोय आणि एक तिची मित्र लोक तिची मैत्रिणी लोक कोणतरी विचारली की तुमचा दादा रस्त्यावर साडी का नेसतोय एक एक दोन दोन रुपये गोळा का करतोय ती विचारली त्याचं उत्तर माझ्यापाशी अजून तर आलं नाही. अजून मी समाजाला काय उत्तर दिलं ना तर माझ्या पुरगीला मी उत्तर देऊ शकत नाही. समाजमध्ये आम्हाला हर एक नावानं पुकारतात इजडा जोगता आणि एम एस सी आणि परत गुंड तर काय आमचा संघ जबरदस्तीला आमच्या बरोबर सेक्स करतात आम्हाला मारहाण करतात आणि तसंच पोलीसवाल्यांचे पण आम्हालाही आमच्याकडनं पैसे वगैरे घेतात आणि दोन दिवस आम्हाला आठवून आमच्या आम्हाला मारून वगैरे आम्हाला आपलून देतात. एकदा मला गुप्तरोगाचा त्रास झाला होता मी सिव्हिलला गेलो डॉक्टरांच्याकडे गेले एका डॉक्टर होता ते मला बघितला मला बघून तो बाहेर गेला उठून ते चार डॉक्टर लोक येऊन अशी मला बघायला आली की कवा बघितले नसल्यासारखं माझ्या संघ ट्रीटमेंट वगैरे दिलं नाही मी ट्रीटमेंटसाठी गेलते का म्हणजे खूप मला त्रास व्हायला होता तर इथनं मी निघून रागना माझे मी आले उठून आता काय करू देवा म्हणून मी गेले प्रायव्हेट दवाखान्यात. प्रायव्हेट दवाखान्यात गेल्यावर माझ्याकडनं खूप पैसे घेतले आणि एवढं पैसे माझ्याकडनं होतं पी मी संग्रामला जॉईन झालो माझे विचारही बदलले. आता मला संग्राममध्ये जॉईन झाल्यापासून मला इज्जत एवढी मिळाली की कुठं मिळाली नसते. मला साडी नेसू वाटतंय मला ड्रेस घालू वाटतंय मला काय पाहिजे ते मी करू वाटतंय. मला
पांडू टॉट अस द मोस्ट इम्पॉर्टंट राईट ऑफ ऑल. पीपल हॅव द राईट to exist how they want to exist. Our work has taught us that people like Durga, Mangala and Pandu, though marginalized by the hypocrisies of the system, like all survivors, they too have the courage and strength to create a world that has much to offer, a world touched not only by their pain, but also their dreams for a society and a people who will affirm their right to self-worth, dignity, and livelihood that no one agency can either confer or deny. Before I end, I have two issues that I'd like to bring to your notice. I take this opportunity to show solidarity to the Alahi brothers, AIDS physicians wrongly imprisoned since June 2008. I appeal to all of you. To sign the petition at iranfreethedoctors.org. That's Cheryl. On 15th June 2010, Cheryl Overs was denied entry to the United States of America on her way to attend a meeting of the Technical Advisory Group of the Global Commission on HIV and AIDS at the invitation of UNDP. Cheryl, as we all know, is a distinguished researcher of sex work, health and human rights activist, and a long-term sex workers' rights advocate. The denial of entry was based on the U.S. government's belief that Cheryl represented a high risk of involvement in prostitution or trafficking of persons, and that she is believed to have a prostitution-related conviction from the 1970s, which nobody can trace. Current U.S. legislation restricts grounds on crimes involving moral turpitude. Moral turpitude? Entry is also denied for any person believed to have been a sex worker in the previous 10 years, regardless of criminal record, and applies to people from countries in which sex work is recognized as an occupation. Nobody from the Netherlands can go to the States. Sex workers, that is. This denial of entry raises serious concerns for sex workers who wish to attend the International AIDS Conference to be held in Washington, D.C. in 2012. Can you imagine a World AIDS conference without the red umbrellas? It's not happening. Thank you. I would like to end this presentation by acknowledging my mentors and co-authors, Joanne Chetta and Jonathan Cohen, Aparna Wilder and Vishakha Datta for the film clips, Francois Zira, of OSI, who held my hand through this process, Kelly Long of ICASO for the magical PowerPoint, you must thank her, my gurus, the incredible collective Vaishya Anyay Mukti Parishad, the also beautiful Kotis and Jogappas from Muskan, and the quietly strong resistors from Sangram Plus. Thank you very much.
Just two short announcements at the end of this session. Today there is an opportunity for you to meet the plenary speakers. Join them between 1 and 2 p.m. in Global Village Session Room 1. And second, on each of your chairs is a postcard. This is a chance for you to sign on to the Vienna Declaration. Please complete the card and return it in the bins by the doors as you exit the plenary session. Thank you. Thank you to the chairs and to the speakers. Thank you.